Please join me in welcoming our chair lady, Kudzai Chichigi, to the stage to introduce our next panel discussion about expanding into the African continent.
Okay, can I please have the speakers on stage? We've got Johan, we've got Ross, we need Mandla, we need Solomon. Who else am I missing? And Danny, yay. This panel is on banking the continent, banking in Africa. So you might be interested to know that banking in Africa is the second fastest growing in the world and the second most profitable of any global region. So there's definitely a lot that's going on the continent, even outside of South Africa. I think in South Africa, we like to think that we know it all and we're in charge, but there's a lot more happening on the continent than probably what's happening in South Africa, and I think it's a very different terrain. Someone asked me a few months ago, before we put the program together, about what the opportunities were. How would you get into sort of an African banking team? What sort of skill set would you need? Is it typically different? Is the work different? And I thought, you know what? Let's just have a panel discussion. We'll ask the guys on the ground. So today we're actually quite privileged to have a group of young handsome gentlemen, I might say, who has a lot of experience on the continent. We have a lot of experience on the continent. They've worked right across from the top right to the bottom of the continent, and we're quite privileged to have them all here. It's very difficult putting this panel together. As you can imagine, because they work across the continent, it's hard to get them in the country all at the same time. Johan flew in just a couple of hours ago from Mozambique. Had my fingers crossed there that he'd make it in time. Anyway, so on this panel today, we've got Ross here on my immediate right. Very brief bio. He's worked at FMB for the last 8.5 years, 5 in South Africa, 2.5 in Zambia, and the last year in Ghana. He's worked in the analytical and consumer banking areas, and he was also part of the first group of candidates to pass the banking fellowship in 2016, also a member of the ASA Banking Committee, and he'll be heading off to Yale to do his MBA in a couple of weeks. So thank you, Ross, for joining us. Then we've got Johan Marie. He's the CEO, one of the two CEOs of FMB Africa. And after working as a skilled laborer on construction sites in London, he realized he had to go and study something worthwhile and ended up doing his actuarial science degree at Tufts. And his journey into banking was a bit of luck, as in 2016 he applied. And at the time, it was still very uncommon for actuaries to work in banking, but he got in and he started as a quantitative analyst in the credit card division, responsible for building credit card models and finalizing the Basel II implementation. Even though he's only ever worked at FMB within the banking space, he's moved around quite a bit, worked in treasury, heading up the credit card division. He's been CEO of two countries, Zambia and Mozambique, and now he heads up FMB Africa. And then we've got Solomon with us. So Solomon, he's actually a chartered accountant, is that right? So he's come to join us today to give us his insights and also his perspective about the value that actuaries also have within the banking space. He's the chief credit officer of wholesale credit for the rest of Africa division for Absa Group Limited. He's responsible for end-to-end management of the credit function, including credit preparation, structuring, sanctioning, business support, restructuring, credit models, credit portfolio management. He's your guy. And he's been part of Absa Group since 2009, and prior to his current role, he worked in various roles within corporate investment banking credit as a credit analyst, and lately as the sector head covering various portfolios in diversified industries, including consumer goods, global corporates, and the public sector clients. And then we've got, who do we have next? We've got Mandla Healy from Nedbank. He's a financial executive for Nedbank Rest of Africa, and this comprises 6 subsidiaries and a 20% investment in EcoBank. It would be great to hear some of his experience on that side as well. And he's been with Nedbank for the last 10 years, and before that he was with Barclays Africa, so we'll get some perspective from that side. And then we've got Danny with us as well. Danny Simwayo, he's a fellow of ASA and a CFA charter holder, and he's now CEO of Standard Bank Group Wealth Africa. And in this regard, he supports business across 14 countries to execute on their wealth strategy. He's got more than 10 years experience in product development, technical marketing, and insurance company balance sheet management. So I've proven to you that these are all highly qualified individuals and they have the right credentials to share with us about their experiences working across the continent today. Okay, so I'm just going to have a few questions and then we're going to open it up to the floor. So not all the panelists will answer every question, but 2 or 3 who feel that they can weigh in on each question will do so. So, firstly, burning question. What is the single most significant challenge of managing a bank in Africa? Let's start with Mandla.
I'll mention two. The first one is regulatory in terms of what SAP wants you to do when you're in these continents, and what even the local regulators want from you, and the legal system, the slowness of the telling of the legal system. And the second one is skill, not to be confused with talent, just the skill that shortages in these countries, especially when you want to proliferate banking products you might have in the home country, so that you can have that seamless banking experience across the continent.
Oh, okay, they can't hear you. Okay, so you at your second point on skill, I think if you can just repeat that point.
I was saying the second point is skill, not to be confused with talent, because there's great talent out there. We just need to provide to skill them up so they're able to provide you to for you to proliferate all the banking products the market needs.
Okay, perhaps you can expand a bit on the skill side, and I think we'll talk about it a bit later, but while you're on it, which skills? Is it on the marketing side? Is it developing products? Is it on the credit modeling side?
Let's talk more credit. For example, you would have, as a group, require requisite processes to go through to provide credit. Your group would require to have models that with the recent implementation of IFRS 9 and all those kind of things, which you might not necessarily have there. So there's a bit of supporting initially, so that you can deliver what you need to deliver. But the key to the sustenance is to make sure you develop those skills in country.
Okay. Johan? So, a bit loud. I think important to note, Africa is not a country.
Okay, so, don't say.
So a lot of people just think it is one big thing and they all operate the same and the regulation is all the same across. And I guess that's the challenge that you face just from going in. Each market has got their own flavor and dynamics that you have to figure out and marry that to kind of your South African, because most of us are South African outgoing companies. So you always have the mothership that wants to see certain things happening in a certain way. You spoke about some of them, the way we do credit, the way we do, you know, online banking, all of these things. So I guess that's the challenge for us on the panel, is when you sit down, is to say, when I go to a country, some of them are more advanced in certain areas. So if you talk regulation, a country quite close to us, Namibia, on the payment space, are actually ahead of South Africa in terms of what they want to regulate. Look, it's not implemented, but it's moving very fast. And then you're sitting with head office that says, no, this can't be, this will never work. So I think there's a few challenges. To put one challenge will be too difficult, but I guess for me it's the first point, Africa is not a country. So in each one, your value propositions, what you stand for, how you get talent, it goes to say, let's unpack the country and make sure I actually have something to offer. Because I'll be the first one to say, you know, from F&B perspective, we're actually not suited for all the countries. There's certain countries where we will never go. I can name one, and it's nothing against the colleagues, but like Angola, we'll never go. We will not go to Angola while it is the way it is. There's various reasons for it, but that already says, okay, then where will we go to profit pools where we can extract value? So I think maybe Africa is not a country.
Goes back to a quote that Yolandi had up, just because there's a gap in the market doesn't mean that there's a market in the gap. So, yeah, thank you for that. Ross?
I think from my perspective, I never worked in the center of international, so I never really worked at head office. I was always in the countries themselves. The thing that I'd say is one of the most challenging things about being managed by the center is deciding the level of autonomy that you give to the subsidiaries. Do you run the subsidiary by remote control from wherever your head office is, or do you allow full autonomy in the countries themselves? Both have their consequences, and anything along the way also has its downsides and upsides. So I'd say getting that balance right for each of the individual countries is quite important, and one of the biggest challenges.
Okay, thank you very much, gentlemen. Now, okay, on to the next question. For those of you who've opened branches from scratch in some of the African countries, so you haven't inherited them from anyone else, what is the simplest and most effective route of establishing a bank in another African country? Do you buy a license from someone? Do you go and talk to a friend of a friend of a friend? Sort of, how do you start?
Maybe if I can just give some words to that before someone else takes over from me, is that I think simplest and most cost-effective are two different terms in that question. So the simplest way is definitely to go and buy something, but that's not necessarily the most cost-effective way. In fact, sometimes it's more expensive, and depending on what you're looking at buying, you need to find the appropriate targets. I'm not sure if anyone wants to take over from there.
You've had my word. I don't think cost-effective and simplicity, they go in one line. Definitely right, my view. Acquisition, I think, is the most simplest way to get into the market. On the other hand, cost-effective, I think today, if you look at the continent and if you look at the opportunities, definitely scalable digital platforms would be the most cost-effective to build ground up, because you're not constrained by limitations and you've got a clean start. Again, that's if you've got that technology and the scale, and that would be my view.
Yeah, maybe I can comment. I think for those of you who had to do any valuations, the PE multiples is quite high in any of these countries, even though the profit pools might not be as deep. So you kind of have this anomaly that you apply our metrics and the thing is worth nothing. It's actually, they should pay you to take it. And then you have to still end up paying something. So I guess to enter, we've done actually all the models. We bought some, so we call greenfields, brownfields, and then obviously, you know, startup. So a full acquisition. I think there's a bit of a market dynamic. So certain markets, you probably want to get something small, but with a scalable platform on digital. And then you have other markets where it's worthwhile to have something big, and then you just add on certain business lines that you don't have. I don't think there's anybody who's got one formula, because it depends on too many factors. But I guess if you ask me, should we start greenfields again, I probably would say no. It's very hard to start from scratch. Even though you can think digital, you can think you put all these things, I think it's more important that you have a customer base. So it's actually more important to buy a customer base, I would say. It doesn't matter what it is. It might be an audit firm. But start with something that you can build on rather than go in with nothing. Because that's a very costly and a long road.
The recent ones we've done, a small one in Mozambique, we started at an associate level where we acquire less than 50%. And then we spend a few years learning with our partners. And then when we are ready to up the investment, then we increase to a majority shareholding where we now consolidate. But of course, we still keep our partners. I mean, they still have the relationship, the connections, especially when now, again, as a head office, we're trying now to get them, not to restrict them, but there are things that we need to implement in the risk and the compliance space. The second one has been a bigger one, the 20% investment in ETI. Because of the size of it and the capital constraints, I mean, it's public knowledge, we are getting a separation from our old mutual. So the capital is constrained. So I think on that one, we'll probably for some time, because of the size, keep to that 20% and associate level, but then learn with them and see if you can get flows of business from either side, either EcoBank or NetBank, so that we can get value, both of us, over and above the equity investment.
Danny?
I think I have not been involved in any bank setup, but I do think it's important to understand the context, to understand the market, how it's structured. In a lot of African countries, you know, you need to understand and know people in the market. So it may be very important to have the right partner, but you need to have the choosing the partner is one of the critical factors that's there. And I think secondly, acquisition, generally when you acquire very big things, there are a lot of things that you won't know because you're not local, that you only find out after you've acquired the the where the bank, and in the bank environment, it tends to be quite tough. And also, I think regulators, by their very nature, they don't want too many banks in the market. So they may force you actually to just acquire, because they want the industry to be consolidated. So I do think there are quite a lot of factors that come into play, and you know, cultural context and all that are important factors.
Okay. Several of you have mentioned the regulator, both sort of as a friend and a foe. And from your perspective, what has been the most challenging regulatory aspect you've had to deal with in entering these markets and staying in these markets? And where do you see the actuarial profession impacting how regulators view these other markets and how we can impact that? So I know it's a loaded question, but what's your perspective? And if you're to be hopeful, what do you see us doing differently?
I think there's been quite a lot of regulatory changes. One of them in Kenya, they kept interest rates that you couldn't go beyond a certain level. And I think they are starting to walk back. I mean, the Minister of Finance is starting to walk back and seeing the impact of that. So I think what I've seen is that there isn't strong engagement between the industry and the regulators. So I think if you look at South Africa, a lot of the time when regulation comes in, there's a lot of engagement between the regulator and the, the regulated firms. And I do think that it's a model that should be taken across the continent to engage a lot with the regulators. And then you can influence the regulation. And it's because a lot of times regulators also talk amongst themselves. So they just meet and come up, they find out someone is doing something differently. They'll want to implement that in their own country without understanding the full impact. So I do think the role that I think actuaries can, just looking at how like ASA engages with different regulators in South Africa, is to what extent can you have industry bodies that do engage with the regulator in terms of even supporting. So if they wanted to keep interest rates in Kenya, to actually do a study where you can submit, what is the full impact of that. Factual information. So I do think from that perspective, being able to provide the necessary skills and understanding of the full implications of whatever you're putting up. And I do think the thing like the actuarial control cycle for me is one of the, a tool that an actuary should be able to use to say, okay, what is the issue? What are the implications? And how do you actually monitor whether the intention of the regulation is obtaining?
Yeah, I guess my only worry with regulation is the speed of change. So what typically would happen, and I think we're all used in South Africa, is there's a bit of a lead time and we all have time to get it in. In a lot of the countries, it's like some of the things we had on the 23rd of December, they tell you by the 27th it must be changed. Okay, so now you sit there and you're like, okay, but no one is here. There's actually no understanding or appreciation for the risk you put the financial system under, which is a lot of times a challenge, and then you end up being non-compliant, but the whole industry is non-compliant. So kind of like the teeth is not there, and then you're all waiting for your fine to come somewhere a little later after Christmas. It's a Christmas present. So I think that's more an issue. And then, as a colleague mentioned, the big issue that actuaries can help is our problem-solving ability, which is not utilized. So you end up, I can give a practical example. So in Mozambique, lots of regulation to take away any fees you charge on retail customers, essentially to provide free banking. So when you do engage and you ask, but what's behind this? They say, no, the teachers up in the north don't earn enough money. They get paid weekly, because you ask them, how do you get to 4 free withdrawals per month? And for this, and they said, no. So they figured it out. They said, no, they get paid weekly. So now, once a week, they must be able to do a free ATM withdrawal, and they must be able to do a free EFT transfer. And then you sit back and say, but you're not going to achieve your goal, because you can't pay for the infrastructure with not getting revenue. So ultimately, you're going to have less of these things you want to encourage. But I guess that was where we tried to illustrate, we can show them, okay, there's a better solution. Even if it goes outside of banking into M-Pesa, as an example, that's a better solution than what they're trying to do at the moment or have done. But I think that's more where we can add value. And For people who go out, I think if you talk to any of them, they would actually welcome that. A lot of them then realize we can help to build the financial models, the you know, financial engineering behind it. But I guess they first regulate and then you try and fix.
I think maybe if I can just add to that. So without trying to be funny, but I think one of the best things actuaries could do to help in with regulation is to go and work for the regulators. I think there's a lot of academics that go that have done economics, etc., that work for the regulators in the countries. But with the skill sets that we have and knowing kind of end-to-end processes, the more banking types of actuaries that will work for the regulators will help the banking industry's life a heck of a lot. Failing that, I know the regulators don't excite everybody. But what we should be doing as an industry across the continent is making sure whenever we do get an opportunity to comment that we really put our hearts and souls into those comments, because we can't sit back and say, oh, the regulation is bad, when we never really gave adequate feedback. Yes, when we get the notifications, I mean, there was one time where we got the letter the 2nd of July, effective the 1st of July. So these things do happen in real life, and obviously there was no time for comment then. But then it's really to try and form those individual relationships with the people working at the regulators, so that at least your bank might get to comment, even if the industry doesn't. At least your bank will get to get a say, and then hopefully you'll then work with the industry players to get that more formalized. So that would be my input of how actuaries can really help change that landscape.
I think just to add to that, I remember years ago when I was still at Deloitte, quite a few of the senior actuaries moved on to go work for the FSB. And clear as day, you saw a lot of regulatory changes that made sense. And the dialogue increased. And Mark did make the point earlier today that South Africa can boast of having the most sort of open communication between industry and the regulator. And I think just to support that point, we've done well in South Africa, but we need to take that practice into the rest of the countries. And to your point of, you can't just wait for them to come knocking on your door. You need to actually put your hand up. And sometimes they don't know they need an actuary. It's like when people started working in banks, no one was actually asking for a banking actuary. They just wanted someone who could solve problems, who had ABC skills, and you sort of just had to put your hand up and take a leap of faith and really invest in the overall system. So I think there is sort of a moral obligation on our side as well, to a point of not just complaining. So a point that you mentioned, Johan, about, and also Dani, about problem solving. So a lot of people talk about the actuarial control cycle, and it's either obvious to you or it's not obvious, of how you implement the actuarial control cycle in your day-to-day problem solving, whichever situation you find yourself in. A lot of people ask me what I do at the bank. I don't do any credit work, I can tell you that. I don't do any balance sheet management. A lot of my work is really outside of the box, but I really only, the only formal education I have is in the actuarial space. So I can say I've used my actuarial knowledge in very non-actuarial spaces. So if you look at the sort of work you've had to do in the other African countries that are not so technical, what can you say is valuable from a financial education or a typical actuarial education? What is valuable from the actuarial skill set that someone can transfer directly without using the words actuarial control cycle or problem solving? Let's be a bit more specific. Start with Dani.
I think you have to help people. I mean, like, I think an hour ago before I actually came here, I was on a call with my people are trying to solve a problem in one of the countries. I think a lot of the time people don't define the problem very well. So to say, you know, when you're sitting with someone, okay, what is the core problem, right? So I think you need to understand the problem that you're facing and what are the key factors that drive how you solution for it. So I think in my mind, we, you know, just reflecting back on that, we had actually got to the end of the call, they were discussing, but they had left like two key parts of solving the problem, and completely everyone was like happy with the solution. And then when you ask, that's when people say, okay, they take a step back. So I do think that the best way to be able to help people is to be able to ask probing questions that say, I mean, have you considered this? Have you considered this? Have you considered this? And then when you come up with a solution, you also need to understand what is the implication of the solution that you're coming up with and how do you actually monitor it in practice.
And also, I think being able to think about banking, in my view, apologies to any bankers that are here, is very rules-based. So there is less judgment in banking. So whenever you try to have discussions with people, they will tell you what the rule says. So is how then do you make them think about the rule, but be able to apply a good judgment? Because a lot of the times the rule is not 100% clear. Someone can interpret it the way they want to make it, and you'll find that a lot of the technical teams, they have got a set interpretation of what the rule means. And they like that. I think it works for in a bank environment. So, but I do think that, you know, being able to sort of challenge people to apply judgment in how they solution for problem without really being constrained too much by rules, I think.
I think I really appreciate your comment, and it's something that's been coming out of the IA Banking Working Group in our discussions, and it's not just here, all over the world. Everyone, every sort of country represented, their representatives say banking has become a tick box exercise. And I think it's so unfortunate and such a waste that you would get the sort of training that the actuarial profession provides you with, and you would go to literally tick boxes. I think, and to your point of, typically someone will tell you what to do, instead of telling you the problem that they want solved. So I've found that that's sort of been the game changer for me in my line of work, is to say, okay, that's nice, but actually what's the problem? Okay, so what are you trying to achieve at the end of the day? And I'll find a completely different way of solving it that's a lot more efficient, probably even more compliant, and everyone's happy at the end of the day. But we're just not thinking. We're just not applying ourselves, and we're not challenging the status quo. And to your point, that a lot of it is quite subjective. There's this regulation that comes out. It's not prescriptive on exactly how you must build the model or what exactly you're supposed to do, so you need to think about it. And I think we really need to challenge one another in, not just, I guess, in the Africa space, but in all the work that we do within banks, to start challenging how we interpret regulation to feed through the system and solve any problem, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. I think, having worked with compliance people in insurance and banking, I can see like there's a significant difference in the way that they apply, you know, judgment.
Yeah, and maybe what's also important to realize is a lot of the countries run very basic banking. So it's more finance focused. So there's a balance sheet and income statement. There's no data being used anywhere in the bank. Somehow some branch manager will tell you this is how many sales we've done, but look, ask how many of them are active, then again, no one knows. So I think that's the other part of our profession that has got a huge role to play, is just to get, you know, data-driven organizations rather than just income and balance sheet. You know, somehow the system spits it out, and then we sit and talk a long time about the ratios. You know, that's kind of what typically in the markets happen. And I guess that it's twofold. Why you get it is a lot of the skills are very thinly spread. If you go to any of the markets, there's north of 20 and actually more like 50 banks in each of these countries, most of them, which means if you just think about credit, you know, you don't actually have that many good people that understand the technicality about it in the market. But then they all sit on fancy titles, head of credit for, you know, head of CIB credit. And when you start asking the questions, you realize there's actually nothing underneath. But they've worked like that and they've got a title. So I guess that's where we can add a lot of value, is just getting to what we think are basics, just using the data, figuring out where you're going, what will work, and actually just understanding what your customer base is doing, I think is a huge plus that we can add in making these things make money.
So I have a direct question for you before we move on to Solomon. So you mentioned data. How good is the data that we're collecting for the other African countries? Is it on par with at par with what we're collecting for South Africa?
I think that depends on many factors. The true actuarial answer. So what happens is it's all there, but just like in SA, the data is never clean. I think some of you who've audited banking credit models would know that you always have to kind of first agree that the data is clean enough. They normally don't correspond 100% with the system, so there's always a discrepancy. So if you don't apply a bit of that insight, then the raw data is not worth a lot. But as you get better and you start making sure, I think Yolandi also spoke about it before, which data points should we collect, where should they be scrubbed and cleaned. So there's quite a bit of work on that, call it data engineering, that I think there is more work to do. But typically for a lot of us, the systems is not the problem. It's just how do they drop the data and how do you harvest it is kind of where the problem sits. So I think there's a bit of work to do. We're getting better, but it's not fixed yet.
It goes back to Rajiv's presentation on sort of where we intersect with the systems and technology teams and what role we have to play in making sure that we're up to speed and we have the tools that we need and we have the data that we need, the quality that we require.
Yep. I think going back to Ross' earlier point around fine line between running a centralized model and to what extent you devolve authority or decision making on the ground. My experience, particularly working with the model risk world, I guess the challenge to this type of skill, it's more around how do we invest ourselves into the businesses, how do we invest ourselves into the culture and understanding the underlying operations of those businesses that we've invested in. I've seen lots of investment in South Africa in data, in models, in infrastructure. But when we get into the continent, my frustration is more the disconnect between the actual business experience that has to be translated into a model. I think there is a huge gap there. I think we can do a lot by spending time in the businesses, understanding those businesses. I think back to Dan's point around making judgment calls that are very insightful. Because I sit in discussions and I sit in the room and often is we can't do this because we don't have data or your data is crap or it's fine, but business is going and we've got competitors, we've got clients and we've been banking them for. So where do we start? Where do we start building? I can't fix what I don't know. I can't fix what happened yesterday, but I need to start building something now, but I need to work with what I have now. And I need to do it to the best of my ability and I have to be able to do it in a way that I'm maintaining my business, but at the same time, I'm able to compete with my competitors. So I honestly believe, particularly in that modeling space, there's quite a lot of talent in SA, but my personal experience, I'm not sure if all the areas of the bank are getting that same experience because doing business in the continent is about being on the ground.
Okay, so we need to get people on the ground. All right, so let's shift gears a bit. Could you describe for us the changing role of banks in Africa, particularly given the rise of mobile money and fintechs, digital banking? How have your organizations been disrupted or had to disrupt themselves within of themselves to keep up?
From our side, I mean, especially mobile money and all that going digital, it's going to affect us more because, I mean, you don't see a need now to go more bricks and mortar in terms of expanding. You can leapfrog using a mobile to reach more clients. Basically, concentrating more on cost to service your existing clients and reaching new clients and getting revenue in that space. Obviously, as you move into digital and mobile, the revenues you get are lesser than your traditional kind of business. That was your cash deposits, cash withdrawal, and all those kind of things. So it's critical as we expand into the digital side of the business to harvest on the traditional business so that you can invest on the new business. But the management of that transition is key and delicate.
Danny?
I think, not speaking specifically to my organization, but I think there's a lot of partnership that you need to explore because what's happening now on the ground is that the fintechs are coming up in every African country. East Africa, there are lots of them. And they're partnering either with, mobile providers in those countries. So I do think that a traditional regulated firm can work with a fintech and a mobile provider. You just need to be very much open to partnership. And you need to develop you know, systems that there's this term called APIs, where you can expose your APIs to other people to actually develop on top of your platform. So I do think there is a huge opportunity for banks to collaborate with fintechs and mobile providers, because I do think mobile providers, a lot of people, there's a huge penetration of mobile across Africa. Fintechs are coming on board everywhere, and I think you just need to find your niche. I was reading about one in East Africa where, you know, a fintech, one of the biggest South African mobile provider, and a bank have all come together to actually be able to execute banking to the unbanked. So I do think that's my view.
Okay, I'd like to know, have any of you been disrupted and started moving in that direction, as Dani has mentioned? Oh, Ross, you can speak, though.
Yeah, so I think across the markets, I think it's true that what they do is they kind of give you a bit of a fright to say customers prefer, because we're all, you know, you're kind of quite arrogant in banking. You think, no, we have all the know-how and all the skills, and we've got the best app and the best whatever you want to call it. And then you realize that your customers are transferring money away from you onto someone else's platform to then start transacting. And I think that's when you suddenly realize, okay, this is not, if I don't, so either I partner with them, or I buy them, or I copy them. So it's one of the three. Yes, so it has happened to us. And then what's good is we have responded in one of the countries with something that will compete, because one of the things that fintechs battle with is they don't have a customer base. So it's very cool solutions, and it is actually, look, it's phenomenal when you see it, but to have 200 customers doesn't help. And I think that's sometimes where what we do is we kind of see in certain markets we partner, or we just go and become part of their ecosystem, as we would call it. And in other markets where we have a fairly sized base and we think we can compete, we will take them head on, because a lot of times things bank are good with is we can move cash. So we all think we've gone electronic. In Africa, we are actually very good at moving cash around. And that's a scarce commodity, believe it or not, where the mobile money guys are really struggling. They don't always have liquidity. So as basic as walking up and just being able to withdraw cash, I guess in South Africa, none of you actually think about it. But in a lot of these countries, you need to be able to do that. And as long as that gap exists, I think that's where banks still have a little bit of a, let's say, a spot above them. And then what we're doing is we're using that as part to innovate new models of distribution, which we think will work well, but we'll have to see. Maybe we sit here in 2 years and then we can talk about it.
So I think from my perspective, I mean, there are opportunities. I mean, earlier on we spoke about lack of data. There's a number of things that I look at. I mean, if you look at a market like Kenya, there's more than 20 banks. Dan spoke about regulations that capped interest rates. So a certain segment of the market overnight became unprofitable. So without scalable mobile platforms, you can no longer bank that segment. So it's a huge opportunity for the banks to collaborate. So mobile providers have the data. Banks don't have the data. It has liquidity. So it's definitely a partnership model. There's also real needs on the ground. I mean, if you look at East Africa in particular, it's a market that is very entrepreneurially driven. So and that environment is very, very informal, and it's likely to remain like that for a very long time. So if you don't digitize and collaborate and bring these innovative solutions, you're not going to be able to do. Some of the things that we really, really are pushing very, very hard is test and learn. And I think Yolanda earlier on was speaking about, I mean, I obviously come from credit, so I'll be essentially one of those people. But we have to embrace test and learn. And I think this is where this crowd will be able to help us in terms of building non-traditional scoring, pricing, risk models, looking at alternative data sources. And I think if you look at the IP that sits here, that's a huge opportunity for the banks. And we're solving real needs. I mean, these are rural people that don't have formal infrastructure. These are agricultural small holdings that are looking for fertilizers and seeds, using mobile wallets for deposits and withdrawals, etc., etc. So definitely it's something that we can look at.
I think that goes to Mark's earlier point about banks moving from just being a moral police force into becoming social engineers. And I think sometimes we underestimate the role that we play in society and sort of shifting the needle in some of these things. You never think that it's fertilized for someone to feed their children who go to school. You just think, well, they're not creditworthy, or our model doesn't quite fit his business model. Anyway, so on to the last question before we open to the floor. What advice would you give to someone who's considering entering the rest of Africa teams within banking, or even looking to open a business in another African country, for example?
I think the first one is to do your homework properly. As my colleague here said, Africa is not a country. It's 54 or 55 of them, which are very different. And secondly, I mean, you must choose what you are good at as a start to get into the market. And work with the local partners, because localization is becoming, days of owning these subsidiaries 100% now are probably gone. So choosing the partner you are going to work with is critical.
One of my favorite things to tell South Africans, being a South African myself, is how many of us have made fun of the Americans for not knowing where their own current country is. I've done it multiple times, or where other countries are on the map, or where South Africa is. I mean, it's in the name. What we need to realize as South Africans is we're the America of Africa. And that might be hard to hear, but the more I've been out further up on the continent, the more I know it's true. So what I'd say is, if you're looking to go out to the rest of the continent, really ask yourself who you are as a person. Are you willing to unlearn a lot of the things you already know? Because they simply just don't apply in other markets. There is a lot of that your experience can help with, and there's a lot of fundamentals and business knowledge that you can take across. But ultimately, you will be a visitor in these countries, and there's a lot to learn from the countries themselves. So if your intention is to go and fix whatever country you're going to, it's going to be a big wake-up call within the first couple of weeks. So I'd really suggest, if you're looking to get into the international portfolio, really examine yourself and see how much you're willing to relearn and experience and get to know people. How much can you change the way you interact with people? Because the way we have our own interactions in South Africa is offensive in other countries. So it's those kinds of nuances that you need to get around and need to think about. Are you the kind of person that can still be successful even if you need to change what might seem like core parts of you?
Yeah, maybe I can add from personal experience. I've been to two countries and I took my family along. Okay, so that's quite a big mission. Those of you who have more, you know, families than just yourself and your partner, it's quite tricky, but what a great experience. So I think if I can answer twofold, family-wise, great experience to go. There's different cultures, different schools. Let's say lots of the issues we face in South Africa, crime is one of them, is not really an issue in a lot of these places. Not in all of them, but in a lot of them. But what's important there is that you immerse yourself in the culture. So you actually have to do a bit of, let's say, studying before you go. This is not just you go and you figure it out yourself. There's quite good organized programs that will teach you a bit about the culture. Where does it come from? How do the people in the collective culture think? Because that's important personally. And then in the business life, it's even more important, because a lot of the countries are non-confrontational. So we would sit in meetings in SA and we debate things and we think that's the way to do it. As Ross mentioned, in a lot of the countries, that's not part of the general culture. So not to say there are not some people who will debate, but most people won't debate. They look at you and they just, you know, they must be thinking a lot of things in their head. And ultimately, the business doesn't go forward. So that's one that you really have to pay attention to and have a feel for the softer side. Then what's important is you have to be quite resilient. There are lots of things that we are used to that doesn't work. So you can't sit and then be complain about it the whole time. Then you might as well stay in South Africa or go to Europe or wherever where things work. So I think you have to be resilient. And then one of the things that I always took with is you have to think out of the box and be quite innovative on getting quick wins on the board. If you're in these teams, it takes a lot of time to get capacity. I think I didn't hear it, but it sounds like it was quite an interesting IT conversation earlier today. It's even amplified when you go to a lot of the countries and you sit there on your own. So you have to find other ways of doing it. You can't just hope someone in SA at head office or your IT team will do it. Your IT team a lot of times are only four people. So there's not a lot you can do. So I think that if you split the two between personal and business, there's a lot of excitement and growth you get from both. And I would recommend it to people who want to try it out.
Okay, are we done? Okay, so maybe let's give our panelists a round of applause. Thank you. And perhaps we can take two questions from the audience before we get ready for our last speaker of the day. Does anyone have any burning question? Kuda. Kuda's got a burning.
Thanks, Kuzai. Sorry, so this is open for anyone on the panel to answer. But Ross raised it initially. When you mentioned that maybe it's very beneficial for actuaries to also work as part of regulators, and they can provide a different perspective. I just want to ask a question, put it a bit further up to say, what are your thoughts in South Africa to have a government actuary, a statutory government actuary to sit, maybe be it in parliament or whatever, but it will be just statutory, just right there?
I think it will be good. No, so I think we experience very similar in the South African, you know, I've worked on both sides. We have a lot more engagement in South Africa, but it's not always as informed. I think it's better on the banking side. I think Saab has got good people and a lot of them have worked in banks and they cross-pollinate quite well. But again, when you get into some of these newer avenues that are mostly data-driven, I guess that's where the opportunity will sit, where there's someone with better understanding of how do things fit together, where I think our profession can add a lot of help in that. And then obviously we didn't speak a lot about some of the Basel III, and in that world there's also quite a big actuarial component, which we didn't touch on in this discussion. But I think if you put all of it together, and at the moment there's also the Twin Peaks, and I'm not too familiar, but I just know it's creating some havoc in the middle when you sit there and you try and operate. So I think it's not a bad suggestion to get a lot of the guys on the same side on some of these complicated topics.
You've mentioned that we need to unlearn certain things and relearn again. Obviously, when you go out and get new experiences, you do learn new things. That's why we do what we do. What would you say, and this is at the panel in general, is your key learnings, let's say just a single sentence, that you most value what you got from your experience in Africa?
Single sentence, checks are still a thing. No, but being serious, the single most important thing that I probably learned in my time on the continent is that there are a lot of stereotypes held by many people that are incorrect. And for me personally, my soft skills have improved a bunch by being in these countries. So that was my biggest takeaway.
For me, the key learning is the ability to influence. I mean, you can't be sitting at a head office here and telling your CFO in Zimbabwe that he must do this and that and that. He will say yes, but it's not going to happen. But if you influence takes a long time, but it's more sustainable, and people see value when you are able to influence them. So I would say influence is a key skill I've learned.
I think from our perspective is to build trust. I think businesses, and trust is the cornerstone. And I think between culture and trust, those were the key things that I had to learn when I started traveling and working. And that actually, I think the more you trust people, the more you embrace the culture, I think the more people trust back, and I think the more it is easier to communicate, and the more it is easier to be able to work together.
I think for me, I think people still do take lunch, and sometimes it's an hour and a half because they go home to eat and all of that. So it's important to be able to appreciate that, you know, people have got a certain way of working. But I think ultimately, I think influence and being able to build relationships, I think people will listen to you more. You know, in South Africa, if you say what you say, people just listen to you. And also, I think it's not everywhere where people call each other by first name. You know, in certain countries, if you call someone by first name, it's a problem. You have to call them Mr. You know, in certain countries, it's not. So it's one of those. So just observing some of those things is interesting.
All right. Thank you very, very much to our panelists. I'm sure you all got something out of that. It's not typically something you'd pick up in your actuarial notes, but I think having the wealth of knowledge on this stage is invaluable and was definitely a delight. And, yeah, maybe you'll get some CVs out of this and build up those credit teams in the other markets. So we just have a few tokens of appreciation. And, yeah, I think let's give our panelists another round of applause.